Hello, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM. I'm Ren Green, and I'm here today talking with Cary Groner about his first novel, Exiles. Welcome, Cary.
Thank you.
I understand you're going to be appearing in town tonight?
At Powell's on Hawthorne, yeah.
What time will you be there?
7:30.
7:30. Excellent. Your novel, Exiles, it's about a Berkeley cardiologist who escapes a toxic domestic situation with his 18-year-old daughter, and they choose to go to Nepal by throwing a dart at a map. And there are a lot of themes about Buddhism and karmic purification. And I'm wondering, what is the seed of this novel? Where did you begin?
The seed, I would have to say, is that, well, first of all, I've been a Buddhist for many years. I studied with a wonderful Tibetan Lama named Chagdi Tulka Rinpoche down in Cottage Grove, Oregon, actually. And studied with him for about 15 years and then studied with his successor. So I've had that interest for many years, but I've also been interested for a long time in evolutionary biology. I read a transformative book several years ago called The Moral Animal by Robert Wright that I think everyone should read, which explains a lot about who we are as creatures and how we got to be this way. And so between those two realms of study and of interest, I started to see some really interesting ways in which those worldviews and those cosmologies overlapped. So my initial idea about the book was to write a kind of epistolary novel, a sort of exchange of letters and ideas between an evolutionary biologist and a Tibetan Lama. And so I was working on that and in its early drafts and ultimately began to think, okay, this is going to be interesting to me and about five other people on Earth. So it occurred to me that it would behoove me to build some kind of narrative structure around that. And from that began the book.
How much like Peter are you?
Not very much, I don't think. Generally, I find that there's a lot of distance between me and my protagonists. I've written this novel and quite a few short stories, and actually, most of the protagonists in my short stories are women. It's unusual for me to write a book about a man, but I sort of made up for that by making the daughter a pretty important character in the book. So in terms of that, it's hard for me to say, you know, because I get a different perspective from friends who have read the book. A couple of friends have said, you know, wow, I can really see you in this character, and it's in some ways it's kind of like having a conversation with you. And that always comes as a bit of a surprise to me because I didn't set out, certainly, to write myself into the character. But I think most writers would tell you that it kind of happens whether they plan to or not to some extent.
Well, I thought it was interesting in particular that he's a cardiologist because really they're the rock stars of the medical world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to hold
mm-hmm.
someone's heart in your hand, it's a very powerful thing. And I'm wondering, why is Peter a rock star? How is that relevant to his character?
Well, in the sense, you know, in the sense of classic tragedy, if someone is going to fall, the farther they fall, the more interesting it is. And from his perspective as a physician, falling from this position on high, you know, where he's working in the rarefied atmosphere of cardiology, to one thing that needs to be clarified about the story is that he initially goes to Kathmandu with a plan to work in a teaching hospital there and to teach and practice cardiology. But that falls through. And so he finds himself then with a backup plan, which is working in a free health clinic, which entails lots of serious infectious disease that he has not really studied, that he's not prepared for, tuberculosis, varieties of infections, trachoma, all kinds of things that third world doctors routinely encounter that he has not really had a lot to do with, at least since medical school. And so he's immediately challenged by what he finds. And then within that context, finds that he is not quite up to it, not really up to the task. And so we have the situation that probably most of us experience sooner and later or later in life, where you have someone who's quite confident of their abilities in one field who finds themselves forced to work some other way and kind of falling apart at the seams about that, not really able to work up to a level at which they'd like to be working.
Well, he's a fish out of water in every possible way.
Indeed he is.
Medically, socially, culturally. And he's in Nepal. And I'm curious, why is he so ignorant of the political situation there? Is that a function of Western knowledge about Nepal, or is that his own doing?
It's kind of a combination. You know, you mentioned the fact that they chose the country by his daughter throwing a dart at a wall map, and although that is true, the point is also made that he's not quite that crazy, and he does, in fact, check it out a little bit. He has a friend who used to be an old climbing partner of his who knows Nepal well, and he has a conversation with him and sort of gets reassured about the situation in Kathmandu. But there's a lot of chaos in his life between the time they make the decision and when they actually get there. And during that time, there are lots of communication problems. There are problems with his email, with his just sort of general how much attention he can pay to everything he needs to be paying attention to during that time. And so it's partly that. It's partly a function of the fact that Nepal is not really covered in the Western press very much, that he had the impression that the Maoist insurrection, which was taking place in the countryside during the time the novel is set, which is 2005-2006, had pretty much stayed in the countryside, and he didn't realize that things had moved so close to the Kathmandu Valley and that, in fact, there was a lot of unrest in the city of Kathmandu itself. Problems with the royal family, problems with the RNA, which is the Royal Nepalese Army, and their right-wing support of various factions.
So it's a combination of his situation, and then things just kind of start blowing up around him.
Exactly. Over and over again, and it only gets worse as the book goes on.
Oh, yeah. It's like, how much more can this guy take? There's a lot of discussion about Buddhism. Mm. He meets a number of monks and nuns and treats them, and he is surprised by their attitudes towards life. And I was struck by, he's talking to a lama, or a lama's giving a lecture about Buddhism, and he says that we're basically strapped to a wheel, and sometimes we're face down in the mud, and sometimes we're looking up at the blue sky, which struck a chord with me because I'm going through my own personal cycles and karmic purification. And what got me about that, I guess, is that in spite of everything he's learning, in spite of the humbling experiences he keeps having over and over, it feels like he despairs a lot. And I'm curious how much of his despair comes from being Western and how much of his despair comes from having Western modern medical training.
That's a really interesting question. I need a moment to think about that. I think I would say that his despair comes partly out of simple ignorance and surprise, not really having encountered the exigencies of medical practice in the third world and how utterly challenging and depressing that can be. I think he had an idea that things were going to be easier than they were. I don't think he was, like, you know, living in a cloud about it. I think he knew there were going to be challenges. I don't think before he went over there, he understood the nature of the challenges or how profound the challenges were going to be, not only to his knowledge and his skill set, but to his very being and his ability to cope. And so I think the despair arose out of the sense that, you know, he could do everything he knows how to do as well as he knows how to do it, and it's never going to be enough. And I think that's the point in the book when he starts to understand that is the point at which he starts to experience despair.
I have a teenager in his last year of high school, and I was really struck a chord. Alex, the difficulties with his daughter, the way she's pulling away from him, that parenting instinct. You know, he wants his little girl to hold his hand for the rest of his life, but he appreciates that she has to move away, and now he's thrown her into this serious situation that he frequently feels guilty about. And I'm curious, do you have children?
I don't, actually.
You don't? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So do you have a model for Alex? His daughter, his 18-year-old daughter?
I do, in fact. You know, partly that the desire to have a daughter in the story arose because I had, when I was researching the book, I had a couple of friends who had actually, they're nurses, and they had separately, several years apart, gone to Kathmandu to work in health clinics and taken their children with them, taken their young children, in fact, younger than Alex is, who's 17 in this story. But nevertheless, they had had that experience, and they were generous enough to give me long interviews with them about what had happened to them there, what kinds of things they ran into. So I had that research as a basis, and I was interested in that because it struck me as a good story, basically, the kinds of things that they had encountered, you know, how having children there had affected their lives, affected their decision-making processes, so forth. But there's more to it than that as well. You know, I've never had any kids, but that's just the way it worked out. You know, my wife and I aren't particularly upset about it, but it just didn't happen that way for our lives this time around. And so, but I've always kind of secretly wanted a daughter, and I thought it would be really cool. And I have several nieces I adore, one of whom lives in Portland, in fact. And the one I'm probably closest to is a niece of mine who lives in the Bay Area near us, who is just graduating from high school, and has a relationship with her dad that's a little similar to the way Peter relates to his daughter. There was some modeling there, I admit. You know, it's a great, healthy, very loving relationship. A lot of kidding, a lot of teasing, a lot of care on both sides. And she's just a great kid. You know, I've known her since she was a baby, and I totally adore her. So in a way, for me, it was writing this story, you know, about a father and a daughter was a kind of vicarious way of experiencing that relationship, which I was not really going to be experiencing in life.
You said that you interviewed people who'd taken their kids to Kathmandu, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, did you use any of their particular stories in your novel?
Yes.
Would you care to share any of them?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Well,
there's one story I'll share.
Okay,
there's one story I'll share. My friend who was from Portland, who took her daughter there, her daughter may still live in Portland. I don't know, but at any rate, if she's listening to this, she'll recognize herself, I suspect. She was only 5 or 6 at the time, but my friend told me they were living in a small place in Jorpati, just east of Kathmandu, working in a clinic there. And life was a bit rough. And they realized at one point over the holidays that they had completely forgotten about Christmas. And so they didn't have any way of getting a Christmas tree, of course. But they did have a burlap bag and a green magic marker. So they drew a Christmas tree on the burlap bag and stuck it to the wall. And I liked that story. And that did end up in the book.
Yes, I do recall that. What is your experience? Have you been to Kathmandu or Nepal? Have you traveled there?
I was writing this book shortly before and during grad school. I went back to grad school a bit late in life. I was at the University of Arizona in the MFA program there from 2006 to 2009. And so I wrote this book. I began working on it shortly before that and then during grad school when I really had no time or money for travel. So I was not able to go to Nepal, but fortunately, I had many good friends who had been, some of whom had actually lived there for several years. And so, you know, I've been a journalist for a long time, and I just kind of approached it the classical way. I just started interviewing people. I tracked down whoever I knew who had been there, and there were quite a few of them, and did long interviews with them, got a lot of very good information from them, and kind of began to construct it that way.
Do you plan to go? Are you hoping to go?
Yeah, I hope to go. I don't know when that will be. You know, fortunately, there's a long tradition of this. I mean, Saul Bellow wrote Henderson the Rain King without ever setting foot in Africa, and the name of the book escapes me 3 or 4 years ago that won the National Book Award, and it was sent, I believe, in Mexico or Central America, and the author had never been there. So this is not unprecedented. Writers do this all the time, and I do think, you know, these days, given the resources available to us via the web, it's so much easier to research things like this than it used to be. It's really incumbent on the writer to get it right. I don't think you can afford to be sloppy. I know that some people took issue with Bellow over some aspects of Henderson, but things were a lot harder in those days. You pretty much had to go, or it was very hard to get the kind of information you needed. That's really not true now. And in fact, I did have the book vetted by a couple of the people who had been to Nepal to just make sure I had everything right in terms of the details, and the physical details and the cultural details, and got a pass. You know, there were a couple things I needed to fix, but basically they were fine.
So your journalism experience really served you well?
Well, particularly in that I've largely been a medical journalist for many years. Uh-huh. And so between that and having a brother who's a doctor, it was helpful because, you know, to write about medicine, you need to know something about medicine, obviously. And I know enough, you know, to get by. And what I didn't know, I could research or talk to my brother about. And he, you know, he did similar things. He vetted the book for me and said, you know, this one antibiotic you mentioned here, actually, that's not for pediatric use. They would have used this other antibiotic in that case. So I was like, oh, great. You know, I could make those kinds of corrections.
So you instinctively went and found experts on the subjects.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've been a journalist long enough that I want things to be accurate. I mean, you can't get, you know, any fiction writer will tell you that you can't get trapped by the facts in a way. You want the truth, but the truth is not necessarily equal to the facts. You know, the truth is kind of a bigger, more amorphous animal to deal with. And so, you know, ideally I like to have both, but you do what you can. In this case, the facts of medical practice are important, and I think it's important to have that stuff right.
When you were a medical journalist, what was your focus in your writing?
I've done a lot of different things for different clients. I've written about cardiology. In fact, I've written about quite a bit about cancer. I've written a lot about diabetes and asthma. For the last couple of years, I've been writing about biomechanics primarily, athletic injuries, different kinds of neurological dysfunction, things like that.
And how did you get to fiction writing from a career in medical journalism?
I just reached a point after I'd been doing the medical journalism for about 20 years that I just thought, okay, you know, I have all these other aspirations. And I, you know, I'm middle-aged, you know, and I need to get on with it because if I'm still writing about this kind of medical stuff 20 years from now, I'm going to jump off a bridge. So I really need to branch out and do more of the things that I really feel are in my heart and that I really want to be doing. And so that's what led me to the University of Arizona, to the grad program there a few years ago, where they were kind enough to offer me a scholarship. And it was a fabulous experience. I think everybody should go to grad school when they're middle-aged. It's just, I appreciated it so much more than I had when I was younger. Oh. and was able to take advantage of the kinds of things they offered me, and it was great.
Yeah, I think college is wasted on 17-year-olds. So you had a moment in your life, sounds like about the same age as Peter, when you needed to make your own sort of karmic leap.
Interesting point. Hadn't thought about it, but yes, that's true.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM. I'm Ren Green, and I'm here today talking with Cary Groner about his first novel, Exiles. So one of the things that Peter faces when he gets to Nepal is child sex slave trafficking, mm-hmm. and prostitution, mm-hmm. Which was horrifying. And he eventually finds himself participating in that without much of a choice. And I'm wondering...
Participating is not the word I would choose in this context. It makes him sound like a demon. In one case, he does acquiesce to provide a medical bill of health to three girls who are going to be sold, and he has to do that or his TB patients will lose their drugs. Let's be clear about what that
yes.
choice is about.
Yeah, okay. He's stuck between a rock and a hard place. Participate was the wrong word. He does give in reluctantly.
Yes.
I mean, he sees he has no choice. How prevalent is that in Nepal or in that region of the world?
I can't answer that question so well. It is in terms of, you know, how prevalent is it, say, versus India, versus Southeast Asia, Thailand, other places where it's extremely prevalent. I'm not really sure. I know that it exists. I know that it's a problem. A related problem in Nepal is that there is a tradition there of poor families in the countryside selling their young daughters as domestic slaves to wealthier families in the city. And that's one aspect of this that I try to bring out, because one of the things that happens around this, Peter, in fact, buys in order to rescue one of these young girls. And one of the things that comes out around that is that she had supposedly been sold as a domestic slave rather than a sex slave. And that's an important distinction, both in Nepali society and in terms of the narrative of this book. And that leads him to a certain amount of leverage that helps him, in fact, break up some of the sex slavery that he's encountered and bring it to a stop. So there is that distinction there. But certainly all over South Asia, sex slavery exists. It's a serious problem. It's a little dicey when you're a fiction writer because, you know, there are issues like that in the book. There are issues about the Tibetan diaspora, you know, the Tibetans who have been exiled from their own countries by the Chinese invasion. And so these kinds of things, you know, you have to find a way to build them into the narrative so that they're a part of that structure so that the book doesn't really become a polemic. But on the other hand, you can't pretend that this is an apolitical situation. The politics of the region affect the narrative. They affect the characters who are there as they affect the real people who live there. And this is set at a specific historical time during the 2005-2006 Maoist insurrection. And so it's always a little bit of a balancing act as a writer. You don't want to ignore the political ramifications of the encounter. In fact, it would be it would be wrong to do so. But on the other hand, you are writing a novel and you don't want to turn it into a polemic. And so you have to find that balance somehow.
Did you ever read C.S. Lewis, The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe? And
when I was very young, I don't really remember it.
There's a scene in one of the books where a character accidentally finds himself turned into a dragon. And in order to escape, he's got to remove his scaly skin and, you know, digging in deeper and just ripping, ripping, ripping. And I got that impression with Peter. He's just layer after layer after layer is removed and torn from him. And pretty early on in the book, he encounters a lama. He goes to the monastery to treat him, and he is told that karmic purification is coming. And I'm wondering, what do you see as the most painful, the most deepest stripping away of Peter in his process? Because he undergoes a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it just keeps coming and coming and coming. And can you name any particular events that you think really beat him down?
Well, I think there's one obvious one, but it gives away so much of the plot that I'm not really willing. I'd rather not discuss it here. It happens rather late in the book. If it happened earlier on, I'd be more willing to talk about it. But it's a significant and important plot turn late in the book, and I think that's really the point at which he's stripped down to bedrock. And you probably know what I'm talking about, but I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, you do start out with him. You start out at a very interesting part of the story. You start out very late in the story, actually.
You open
with the capture of Peter and his daughter and a companion by Maoists. And I'm wondering why did you choose to just dive right in?
Well, in one way, you know, it's just a kind of, it's just a hook, to be honest. You know, it's a principle of narrative structure that you want to get your reader's interest as early as you can. But beyond that, there's a reason for that. It's not just the sort of crassest commercial aspect of it. For me, narratives are very much more interesting if we know something about where we're going, and then the reading process is about finding out how we got there, rather than the sort of simpler progressive narrative structure where you're just sort of seeing what happens next. I think the how do we get there is much more interesting to me as a reader than what happens next. And so that was part of that decision as well.
So you showed that he was up a tree. You got him up
Indeed.
A tree immediately.
Yes, yes.
And I read the reviews on your website and called it fast-paced. That is true. The book is a wonderful read, actually. I loved it. I enjoyed it very much, and I could see some of my own processes in your novel. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your writing?
Not really. It's always a little artificial when a writer gets up and starts pontificating about his own work, because ideally, the work speaks for itself, and then when you start speaking for it, it becomes a bit redundant. But it's interesting to know what's in a writer's head and why he or she goes about the things they do. So I don't have a lot more to say about it. You know, my hope for the book is that it, in terms of beyond just the fictional aspects of it, that it would bring some public attention to the situation of the Tibetans and their displacement from their own country. You know, those of us who are in that circle, it feels like, you know, that knowledge is omnipresent and lots of people know about that. And in fact, that's not really true. I find repeatedly that vast swaths of American people don't know anything about that. The 1949 invasion, the subsequent, you could call it a genocide safely, I think. More than 1 million Tibetans have been killed. And again, as a fiction writer, you have to tread that ground carefully. You're not writing a diatribe. You know, there are plenty of nonfiction sources available for that information, and they are on my website. But I think it's, you know, again, you can't pretend that it doesn't exist, because the Tibetans that I know have been very generous with me with their knowledge, and I feel it's important to acknowledge that in this conversation and in the, you know, any discussion of the book.
What about writing this novel? Where in the process, what, or the story, what gave you the most pleasure in it?
It's all pleasurable for me. That was one of the reasons I decided I needed to make this career change, because one writer once said, I think it might have been E.L. Doctorow, I'm not sure, said that writing a piece of fiction is like driving somewhere at night. You know, you can only see as far as the headlights reach, but that's enough to make the journey. And for me, that process of discoveries, things kind of arising suddenly in front of you, and there they are, and you're just, and all writers talk about feeling more like a transcriptionist than a creator, you know, at a lot of times. And I think that's true. It's a truism of fiction writers, that's how the work unfolds often. And I find it immensely satisfying and very pleasurable. And for me, there's no greater way to make a living. I hope I actually do manage to end up making a living at it.
Do you have a next project in
there?
I have
two finished manuscripts, which are with my agent now. One is another novel, and one is a collection of stories. And so she is just about to start going out with those to editors, so we'll see how that goes.
Excellent. I'm Ren Green. You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM, and I've been speaking with Carrie Groner, the author of Exiles, a novel. And Carrie, would you like to tell us where you'll be again tonight?
I will be at Powell's on Hawthorne, Southeast Hawthorne, at 7:30.
Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.